welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline Diest, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. Hello and welcome to Right Through the Roof. Today I'm speaking with Berhan Wazir. Hi Berhan, how are you going?
Hi Madeline, very well, how are you?
Very good, thank you. A little bit of background about Berhan. He is an award-winning writer and editor based in London, previously at Al Jazeera, The Times and The Observer. He's also written and presented documentaries for British television, and he's currently the consulting editor at WikiTribune, a new media platform set up by Jimmy Wales, the Wikipedia founder. So thanks for sparing the time to speak with me today, Berhan.
You're welcome.
Excellent. So how I like to start off is a little bit of kind of warm-ups, some, I don't know, sit-ups, some kind of jogging on the spot just to get you kind of limbered up because it's quite early there in London. So just some short, sharp questions. So you write, I've seen you write interviews, you do opinions, you do other reporting. So what's your favourite writing?
Usually kind of long-form features, which is obviously kind of increasingly, well, sometimes hard to get space for. But anything, if I can spend, you know, up to, you know, a month, couple of months researching and interviewing people, that's usually the most, for me anyway, that's usually the most productive type of writing.
So how long do those pieces generally in terms of word count, how long will those pieces be?
I think they can go anywhere up to about 3,500 to 4,000. In the, I mean, I usually have to try and like fit them in around work, but they can take it, you know, anywhere up to like about a month to a couple of months to do the kind of reporting, you know, especially if I'm speaking to, you know, historians or kind of, you know, other types of experts who might not live here.
Mm-hmm. So you do that as a side gig, do you, to your editing work?
Well, yeah, it's funny you should ask me that because I had been an editor for 10 years. I'd been a reporter before that. And I guess at some point in about 2015 or 2016, I decided that, you know, I did not want to do that volume of editing anymore. You know, I'd spent a decade at it, and I was kind of particularly keen to find something that would allow me to do as much writing as I could handle, you know. And I'm very happy writing like one piece every month or one piece every couple of months. That kind of turned into a bit of a thing, really. You know, I was kind of quite adamant that I wasn't going to spend the rest of my time, you know, managing budgets or staff holidays or that kind of thing. And I was quite keen to get back into writing.
So when's your favourite time to write?
Well, I'm a bit of a morning person, so that to me really helps. I think that, I'm quite productive first thing in the morning, so any time from 5:30, 6 onwards for a couple of hours. If I can usually do a couple of hours of either kind of, you know, writing or kind of, you know, reading, you know, I find actually I can get through like quite a lot in that space of time.
Mm. I'm a bit similar to that, and then you can also kind of forget about it for the rest of the day and feel kind of productive. You've got it out of the way.
Yeah, I went to a friend's house for dinner a couple of weeks ago, and I guess my phone was on the table, but when my phone is resting, I think like around about 11 o'clock or something like that, there's an indicator of when the alarm is set. And then somebody at the dinner just glanced at my phone and realized my alarm was set for 5:30, you know. And that kind of sparked actually quite an interesting 30-minute conversation with people saying, you know, I would never dream of getting up that early in the morning. And then I was trying to persuade people that actually that's a really productive time, and there's been a lot written about how productive people are that early, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I have a day job and I do the same because I have found that really good to get up at 5-ish and do that work.
Yeah. I think it also, I tend to find that it really kind of helps focus the mind as well, because, you know, if I've done a couple of hours and then I go to work, you know, I'm not like other people who are kind of slowly, you know, awaking. I feel like I've already done that by the time I've got to the office, and I've usually thought through what I'm going to be doing for the rest of the day.
And everyone else hates you because of it. I used to, I've done that before. I've had teams and I've come in and I'm already like, all right, this, that and the other. And they're like, oh, just give me a coffee.
Everybody hates that person.
There's actually a hashtag on Twitter, which is 5 a.m. Writers Club. You should be off
Twitter. Ah, okay.
Well, you should be off Twitter when you're doing your writing, but there is a 5 a.m. Writers Club hashtag.
Ah, I'll look that up.
Okay, good. So with your early morning writing sessions, what's your writing fuel of choice?
I usually have a coffee in the morning, and then I'll start with the coffee. I usually do a little bit of kind of rereading if I've written something the day before. And then I'm kind of fairly old-fashioned. I'll have, fairly old-fashioned and fairly Scottish. I'll have porridge. So that's usually the fuel of choice in it. And that seems to be the fuel of choice regardless of the weather, 365 days a year, really, you know.
Oh, wow. The proper Scottish with salt or you go the sugar?
I'll usually have like a little bit of salt and actually a little bit of honey.
Okay.
Yeah, which I'm sure like traditional Scots would probably be appalled by. I actually think porridge is like incredible fuel, because, you know, like you just need to have a little bit and it really does sustain you for the next few hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great. Well, we've got to know you a little bit more. You're the first person I've had on the show who's talked about porridge, so that's great. So let's get a little bit more in depth. So how do you describe your writing and what themes do you like to explore?
I think I describe it as always a kind of work in progress. I'm usually like never happy until right at the end. I think usually it's kind of trying to figure out the process is usually one of kind of constant refining, which I'm sure isn't, you know, is kind of very, it's probably universal for everyone. So I usually I'll kind of draft as I go along. So like basically everything ends up in a Word document, like, you know, interviews if I've done them, the transcripts, like any cuttings, historical research, everything ends up in the same Word document. And then the idea is then to kind of start drafting from that once I feel I have enough. And then in terms of interests, I lived in Abu Dhabi in Qatar for a few years. So I'm particularly interested in the Middle East. I'd reported on the Middle East before that. I covered the Second Gulf War. I think the one interesting thing about coming back to the UK for me, and this seems to have kind of like sparked quite a lot of the writing, is that, you know, I mean, I think Britain is going through a particularly interesting conversation at the moment with Brexit and with its kind of history of kind of immigration. And that seems to be like a kind of daily thing, like, you know, the news agenda really kind of tends to revolve around that. And that to me has kind of been a kind of interesting thing to write about. I think partly because, you know, after having spent 7 years in the Middle East, where in two countries where there is a huge amount of immigration, you know, I mean, Abu Dhabi and Doha, the foreign populations of both of those cities are, you know, well into 80%, 85% even. And so to kind of come back here and find that, you know, that there's a kind of, you know, a fairly sizable unease with immigration when, you know, say, for example, Muslims only make up like 3% of the population.
Really?
Yeah, they're tiny, you know, 3.6%. So that's, you know, I mean, that's that to me strikes me as like either people don't know enough about the changing role of the UK, or people don't know enough about, you know, their neighbours, for example, you know. But that's been an interesting thing.
It's although we're not facing into the same choices due to Brexit, Australia's very much the same. We've still got the hangover as well. We must be following you guys as usual. So you mentioned that you were never happy with your writing, and it's always a work in progress. How do you push yourself ahead, and just how do you get to a point where you're satisfied enough to submit?
Well, I think there's quite a kind of stark difference between there's quite a stark difference between the initial drafts and then what I usually end up with. There's a kind of thread of, like, certainly in Britain, of journalism, where there's usually kind of less analysis, mm-hmm. and it's much more about the personal. So, you know, like typically, quite often an editor will say, well, you know, can you kind of flesh out the first few paragraphs and just like tell me exactly what you think, you know, how this relates to you. And I tend to very much avoid that. Like, I don't usually write personal histories or even kind of personal opinions. The trade-off is usually if somebody asks me for that, like, I'll usually then like barter, you know, I'll say, look, you know, I'll do 5 paragraphs on that, but I really don't want to do any more, you know. But that's obviously, you know, for certain subjects that can be like a very valuable hook, you know, like if you have some personal experience of what you're writing about, you probably should, you know, let readers know that, you know, you have tried this or you have lived through this, you know. And then I think, like, usually the kind of more long term, well, if I was to think about like how much time I usually spend on writing and how much time I spend on rewriting, it's probably 20% versus 80%. You know, which doesn't sound very productive when you think about it.
Well, I suppose it's that first write to kind of work out what you're trying to say and then refine it.
That's right.
Cool. Okay, so the big question I like to ask is what is the one thing that you think has been most helpful in improving your writing?
Oh, definitely reading other good writers. So, yeah, I mean, I think... just kind of reading the kind of things that I would like to write or the kind of things I'm trying to write, and then really trying to figure out, like, you know, I think structure really helps. It's hugely helpful. So, like, everything has to be, you know, somewhat kind of planned out at the beginning. And then I'm usually kind of looking at what other people have written, and I'm trying to think that, like, you know, how do you, like, get to that level of, like, I mean, I'm going to call it analysis, and I guess it is, but it's also, like, on this particular subject, you know, how does this really, really relate to, like, the world that we live in? You know, like, it's I've just written a piece about the history of British mosques, mm-hmm. For the New Statesman, And that's really been about, like, kind of, you know, speaking to architects and speaking to historians and then, like, visiting a bunch of them. And then really trying to figure out, like, why, you know, why is it that 70%, over 70% of Brits have never been inside of a mosque? You know, like, there must be some sort of institutional reason for that, you know. And, like, that to me, that's what's particularly interesting, like, you know, like, finding out why that might be the case, less so what I think about it.
Interesting. So any particular writers that inspire you at the moment?
I think I would have been in my early 20s when I came across William Finnegan, who writes for The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And he had written a book called Brave New World, which was really about kind of like teenage drugs, poverty and violence in the US. And that was like a really formative book for me. I mean, I think I don't even think I was in my early 20s. I think I just left university. But that was really formative for me because that was essentially what I really got from that was like the sense of balance, you know, that like here's somebody who had spent, you know, at least a year living in, I think it was like 4 or 5 towns that had these problems for different reasons, you know, and had really kind of found a way to kind of write this without any sense of like sensationalizing or dramatizing, you know, the violence and the drugs and the poverty was kind of matter of fact. And that really struck me, you know, like that really struck me because it was the idea that he was really just a fly in the wall. He was a vessel to tell this story and he wasn't going to extrapolate too much from that.
Okay, good. Because that kind of style has changed a bit more, hasn't it, as you were talking about before, about people more inserting themselves into the story as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I was the opinion editor at Al Jazeera for a while, and that always struck me as well. So, I mean, I think, like, especially, there's been a shift in the last decade or 15 years where, you know, media is kind of increasingly full of columns, you know, like personal takes on situations. And I think like some of that stuff, if it's really well done, is obviously of great value. But I think it can get to the point where like it's kind of all encompassing, you know. And I guess the tricky thing is to find that balance.
So with your writing, are you trying anything new at the moment? Any new techniques or...
I've made a kind of concerted, well, certainly since I got back from the Middle East, I've made a kind of concerted effort to try and uncover as much history as I can, which can take a lot longer. But it's really like, you know, the kind of fundamental questions that I'm usually trying to figure out is like, you know, why is this happening? Why now? And obviously this is not the first time. So, you know, what was it like when this first happened, say like 100 years ago, you know? And that usually means like a lot more kind of reading and a lot more interviewing, but it's, you know, it's fairly kind of instructive, you know? I mean, like I'm usually, you know, like as anybody who thinks that the world is an incredibly complicated place these days, I'd argue that it, you know, it always was. And we should try and figure out, you know, what got us to this point.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that generally recently as well. So I was wondering whether it's also something to do with being getting a little bit older when you start to, and especially I've been reading, I didn't do history at university or anything like that, but reading a lot of historical fiction set in like, you know, the 1100s and just go, you know, how multicultural was it then, you know, as compared to today?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's, you know, I think that's something that seems to be kind of fairly, you know, I mean, my history at my school, for example, consisted predominantly of World War I and World War II, you know. There was no kind of pre-World War history. There was very little contemporary history, you know. So I think, like, you know, there's obviously, there can be like a kind of knowledge gap there. I think also in terms of like where Britain is at the moment, you know, it's fairly useful to kind of go back and say, you know, like there have been huge benefits to our relationship with Europe, our kind of historical relationship with the US. I mean, you know, it's quite an interesting time here because we've gone through like a decade of austerity. And I think that, I think the profound effect of that decade of austerity is felt by Brits in all kinds of ways that, you know, people haven't really even begun to think about yet.
Interesting. Okay, well, you sound like you're a busy guy, so I'll start to wrap up and let you get on with your writing and or get to work. So are you working on anything at the moment that you'd like to talk about?
I've just finished a couple of pieces. The piece on the history of British mosques was really interesting to write. I mean, the general view of British mosques here seems to be that, like, you know, these are kind of, you know, somewhat clandestine places. Well, these are places of kind of clandestine activity and not many people really know what seems to go on inside. But actually, British mosques have really been at the heart of, like, Britain's relationship with empire, you know, like the original meetings to break for Muslims and for Indians or Indian Muslims, the original meetings to break away from the British Empire and kind of forge India and Pakistan. A lot of this stuff actually happened in British mosques, you know. Haile Selassie, for example, the Emperor of Ethiopia, held like crucial meetings as he visited British mosques, you know, during Ramadan, for example. So that to me was quite an interesting thing to write about. That, like, you know, here's this kind of sense of, like, you know, fairly important history, and all these kind of key decisions have been either discussed or taken in these places. Plus the huge amount of, like, charitable work that goes on. I mean, you know, some of these places are raising, like, hundreds of thousands of pounds for, you know, not just Muslim causes, but every cause you can think of. And that seems to be, like, fairly overlooked. I thought it might be helpful to kind of write about that.
Yeah. So how old is the oldest mosque, or when was the first mosque built in Britain?
Oh, 1889.
Wow.
Yeah, and actually the first mosque in the UK was actually a conversion. It was a house which was converted into a mosque in 1889 by, and this is what struck me, so the people responsible for the first mosque here were Muslim converts.
Okay.
These were Christians who'd converted to Islam.
Wow. There you go.
Yeah.
Excellent. And yes, I really enjoyed your piece for Roads and Kingdom about the Rotimatic as well.
thank you.
That was a really interesting.
That was fun.
Yeah. This is an automatic machine that makes roti. And so did you really test it out for a while at home?
Yeah, I mean, this is a kind of somewhat ludicrous machine because it's 44, 45 kilograms. It costs about $1,000. It was a bit of an effort getting it unpacked and kind of set up. It's for something that's for something that kind of, you know, boasts to be so modern. It's essentially a robot. When it's up and running, it's very much like something from the kind of steampunk era, you know. So it's incredibly noisy. I mean, it's louder than any other gadget I've got. It's louder than a washing machine, for example, or a dishwasher, which is frankly unbelievable. And then it takes like 6 minutes to warm up, where it makes all these noises. It's got like canisters for like oil, water, and flour. And then it produces these like small kind of palm-sized rotis, which are really nice. But it's, you know, it's 45 kilograms and costs $1,000, you know. And, you know, friends who've visited, so it takes up like a huge chunk of like counter space. And friends of mine that have visited have like immediately walked into the kitchen and said, you know, what the hell is that thing over there? You know, like it's bigger than your microwave, you know. And I've kind of explained that, you know, and then obviously they want to switch it on, and there's a kind of digital counter, and it makes all these kind of screeching noises. But, you know, I mean, I guess the interesting thing about that one was that, like, you know, here's like a very modern solution to an age old problem, which is that people don't want to kind of knead their own dough anymore because it's really messy, you know. And then actually that then got me thinking, well, you know, there's probably a better story to be told here about like how that food got from India and Pakistan to here, you know. And that's, you know, and why is that so, you know, if Italians have pasta, you know, like if everybody has bread, you know, like, you know, food is usually memory. And then so, you know, I mean, that there's a kind of younger generation that doesn't really cook this stuff anymore. I don't think this is going to be the answer for them, but you know, like it was trying to figure that out.
Good. All right, I'll direct any listeners to that to read for themselves. But it was good fun. Okay, so let's wrap up. So, if people are interested in finding out more about you, where's the best place they can find you online?
I've collected everything on my website, which is barhanwazir.com. And then all the usual day to day work is usually posted at wikitribune.com, where I spend most of my time kind of editing news pieces. But that's very satisfying. It's a community project, which is really good fun.
It's a community project.
Well, it's quite a different model for journalism. It's the Wikipedia idea, which is that people donate. And then like charitable institutions donate as well. The idea is that these stories are kind of living documents. You know, we are not beyond getting things wrong every now and then, but that actually the community then kind of weighs in to help. And that's been really rewarding. I mean, we've met community members a few times, and you really kind of sense that, you know, like, you know, everybody generally has like the best intentions at heart. You know, like it's really interesting seeing, you know, something will get posted, and for example, like there might be a comma missing, or there might be a comma in the stray place, and it's usually fixed within 5 minutes. You know, like somebody will go on and say, oh, I've moved that comma from here to there because I think you guys had like put it in the wrong place. And people will kind of flesh out with, you know, people will make suggestions over, you know, what we should maybe cover, who we should interview. And there seems to be very little kind of, you know, arguing online, which is really nice.
Good. All right. I'll have to check it out a bit more. Okay. But thank you so much for your time and talking us through your feature writing process. It's been really interesting.
Thank you, Madeline. That was lovely.
Thank you. One of the questions I often ask my guests, it's about any writing rituals. And this question comes from a story I read about Victor Hugo writing in the nude. Apparently he'd hand over his clothes to his servants and ask them to take them away, so he was forced to write because he couldn't leave the room. Seeing as it was Friday the 13th last week, I thought I'd share some more strange writing rituals and superstitions. Isabel Allende begins all of her novels on the same date, January the 8th. This is because she started writing her very first and very successful novel, The House of the Spirits, on that date. Similarly, Truman Capote refused to begin or end a piece of writing on a Friday. He also used to lie down when he wrote. British poet Edith Sitwell would lie in an open coffin before she began to write her poetry, claiming it helped her to clear her mind and focus. It's also claimed that American poet Joaquin Miller installed sprinklers above his house because he believed he could only write poetry to the sound of rain pouring on his roof. Friedrich Schiller needed the smell of rotten apples to work. He kept rotten apples in his desk drawer and would inhale the smell whenever he needed inspiration. John Steinbeck wrote all of his drafts in pencil and always kept 12 perfectly sharpened pencils on his desk. And Alexander Dumas wrote all his fiction on blue paper, his poetry on yellow paper, and his articles on pink paper. Now, when Joan Didion is close to finishing a book, she sleeps with it beside her. She said in a 1968 interview with the Paris Review, "Somehow the book doesn't leave you when you're asleep right next to it." Now, Dan Brown believes in hanging upside down as a cure for writer's block. Inversion therapy helps him to relax and concentrate better on his writing. And the more he does it, the more he feels inspired to write. And while we're also on this, in terms of some interesting writing fuels of choice, apparently Agatha Christie used to crunch on apples in her bathtub while plotting her novels, Flannery O'Connor was obsessed with vanilla wafers, and Vladimir Nabokov liked to eat molasses. Now, my own ritual seems a bit boring after all of this. I find I can't write with my shoes on. I am so used to writing barefoot or in socks, I feel a little bit uncomfortable with the fact to write in shoes, which is not great when I'm in a library or on a plane. But then again, I quickly get over it because I need to grab my writing time whenever I can. So I hope you've been inspired by some of these odd rituals. So what is your writing ritual or superstition? Thanks for listening to Write Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?